Well, good morning. It's Per Fagrang, KBOO News and Public Affairs, and today we're going to talk about money. And our guest is Alan Rosenblith, who, a couple of years ago made a movie called The Money Fix. And the movie has been kind of updated and redone, and is going to be a sneak preview coming up at the Hollywood Theater on Thursday, January 29th. So put that in your calendar. I saw the original movie, and it's really interesting. It explains the money system very well. So tell us about this movie.
Yeah, well, hi. Thanks for having me on the show again. I've been working on this project for about 4 years, and it's gone through several iterations. One of the, difficulties is that, money, when I started this, I kind of had no idea how complicated and, confusing the subject money is. And I've had to redo it several times just to sort of get down to the basics and really figure out, what actually is happening and how do we communicate that in a way that's clear and concise. We did a kind of test screening a couple years ago at the Hollywood.
This is for the original film?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, it's fairly well received, but obviously given that what's been happening in the economy and everything, I thought it was, time to kind of give it an overhaul and really make it relevant. So
I thought it has a nice graphics, how money comes into existence.
Yeah, this is one of the least well understood things about money. Most people generally assume that it's the government that creates money in one way or another, and that's actually not true. It's the private banking system, and the Federal Reserve's role in this is to kind of regulate it and make sure it doesn't get too out of control. But essentially, it's private banks that issue money as debt, as debt in some
right.
accounts.
This is the thing. I read very recently that 97% of all the money in circulation is not, dollar bills or anything. It is debt, money that is loaned into existence.
Yes.
That's almost just about our entire money supply has been loaned into existence. So tell us how that works.
Well, why don't we back up here for a second? And before we kind of get into that, why don't we look at what money actually is? Because a lot of economic textbooks talk about what money does. They talk about it as a standard of value, a medium of exchange, or a store of value. That's a little bit misleading because that's what money does. That's its function. The nature of what it is, though, is information. It's not a tangible commodity type of thing. It's actually information about who owes who what. So if you have money in your pocket, then people in your community owe you something. And if you're in debt, then you owe the community something. And that's been true since day one with money. I mean, if you go back to cowrie shells, tobacco, or gold or anything, that is the nature of money. And all of these different...
Well, it's a claim on somebody's goods or services.
Exactly. So all of these different forms that money has taken over the years, be it, shells or arrowheads or whatever, those are just carriers of information. They're just, mediums. They're not the actual nature of money itself. So the actual nature of money is something that's information. So what happened at around the Renaissance was the invention of fractional reserve banking. And what they realized, some very clever folks... the Medicis, among others, realized that you could actually loan out more money than not be limited to the actual quantity of physical stuff, money or gold coins in that particular case. So these gold coins would be in the bank and they would loan out way more claims for them as loans than there actually were gold coins in the banks.
Now, so it's like... you have money in your account, and the bank loans that out and puts money in somebody else's account, and then they can loan part of that, and so it's just sort of like a ripple effect.
Yeah, well, you can think of it like this, that if you're, let's say it's the Renaissance, you come in with a bag of gold coins, and you want to keep these safe, right, because there's always going to be robber barons and, that kind of thing, people trying to get your money. So you put it in the bank. The bank has a nice big safe spot, and the bank... then issues you a receipt, and it's a receipt that you can, at a later point, come and claim your gold. Mm-hmm. Now, what the bank realized, and this is a tremendous advance and probably in many ways enabled our entire civilization as we know it, which we'll get into in a second, but they realized they could print more receipts than the gold that was there. And mm-hmm. and they could print these receipts and lend them out to people as loans. And that would work if the people repaid the loans with interest. And the interest was meant to cover the risk associated with the people not, because occasionally if somebody doesn't repay the loan, there's outstanding claims on this gold and the bank is kind of, mm-hmm. you know, got itself in a bit of a pickle. So the interest was originally meant to cover this risk of having more loans outstanding than there were coins in the bank. So that's was a tremendous, tremendous advance. And, you know, because of the incredible amount of new money that that enabled, because before we were depending on a very scarce commodity, gold, which meant that people were hoarding it, you know, putting it, tucking it away. Mm-hmm. And it really held up the process of trade and you know, community building. Another interesting thing, just as a quick aside, the word community actually means to give among each other. Mm-hmm. So even the word community itself has very economic overtones. So they had wonderful, you know, new advances in during the Renaissance, and you know, basically the entire that whole surge of development came about as a result of that. The one thing that was a problem, though, was that when they, as a systemic problem, and this sort of became more and more pronounced as time went on, was that if you charge interest on all money that's being created, all this credit, mm-hmm. then if you kind of do take a step back and look at this sort of systemically, what you notice is there's actually more money owed to banks mm-hmm. than there is in circulation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means, you know, let's say you're going to, in today's world, take a loan to buy a house, right? So you go and you take a $100,000 loan, and the bank will charge you a certain percentage of interest on that. And let's say over the next 20 years, you have to bring in $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so your total debt to the bank is $200,000, but the total new money that was created was only $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that's actually how all money is created. So all money has this inherent scarcity built into the system where there's always more owed to banks than there actually is.
They can never catch up.
Yeah. So the only way they can, you know, this whole system doesn't fall apart is if they keep making more and more and more loans.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing now in terms of the current financial crisis is, I've heard it referred to as peak credit, actually.
Yeah, okay.
You've heard about peak oil. There's been a lot of talk about peak oil. Mm-hmm. This might be referred to as peak credit, mm-hmm. which means that there really aren't new places in the earth, in the planet anymore, in culture, to absorb new credit, new debt that's being created. We've kind of completely globalized mm-hmm. every country, every culture for the most part. And there's really no new places that can absorb this kind of debt. So we've reached this sort of mathematical limit of the money supply.
Let me say, this is KBOO. We are talking with Alan Rosenblith, who made a film which will be showing at the Hollywood Theater called The Money Fix. And so that is at January 29th, the sneak preview. And so we've hit the peak of credit.
Yeah.
And so what happens then? I mean, there's obviously some people are not going to be able to pay their loans.
Well, yeah.
What happens then? Where does all that money go?
I think we've heard a lot of talk in the news about the credit crunch. Mm-hmm. And what this basically means is that, you know, as these loans become unrecoverable because there just isn't the money out there to mm-hmm. repay them, the banks are not making new loans as the old loans come in.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the big problem, in mm-hmm. essence. This is the big problem of what's happening right now. And why they're talking about bailouts and even going as far as nationalizing banks. I mean, I just read that mm-hmm. this morning in the New York Times that was a pretty real possibility now. But the important thing to remember about all of this is that it's kind of just, as Bernard Leotard says, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. the essential nature of the money is fractional reserve banking. And that game where there's going to be more money owed than there is in existence mm-hmm. is what is coming to an end right now. Mm-hmm. Now, I find much more interesting what is going to happen to replace that.
Right.
Because
I can ask you that.
I think, you know, there's a lot of reason to be concerned. And of course, whenever the subject of money comes up, people tend to get pretty worried about it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a worrisome thing. Our personal experience with money is...
Well, all these people lost their money to Bernie Madoff, you know. I mean, it's really heart-rending. Some people, you know, who living the high life, all of a sudden they...
Absolutely.
They're down here with us.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if we look on kind of an individual level, all of our individual experiences with money is that it is scarce. You know, we are always, you know, there's always kind of this tension between our obligations and what's coming in the door or mm-hmm. what's coming in the bank account. So I think we have to look at kind of some of the broader patterns of wealth creation that have been developing over the last 20 years, but I think particularly over the last 5 to 10, and look at sort of participatory wealth creation models. It used to be that, you know, in the industrial world, you needed to concentrate huge pools of capital if you wanted to do anything. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the way Bernard Lyotard, who's the former chief banker of Belgium, used to say that, you know, you don't build a factory with, you know, pocket change. You know, mm-hmm. you have to have a mechanism that concentrates wealth if you want to build a factory, just by the nature of what a factory is. It requires a lot of money in one place to do. And that's what our current monetary system does extraordinarily well. And I actually don't think this is a bad thing. I think this is a very good thing. We enjoy a very high standard of living because it does that so well. However, what we are seeing with the information age, the emergence of the information age, is that new forms of wealth creation become possible. I think the most striking example of this is probably in the open source community, where people, you know, where software is not considered something proprietary. It's something that is a collaborative, that people make in a collaborative way together because they mm-hmm. realize that by collaborating, everyone has more to gain.
Mm-hmm.
I think other great examples of this would be Wikipedia, what Wikipedia has done to regular encyclopedias, what has happened to the record industry, the CD and record industry as a result of peer-to-peer file sharing. All of these things, if we look at all of these kind of and try to examine what are the patterns that are the common denominators between them, we see that in every case, a function that was formerly centralized became distributed in some way. So it used to be, to use the example of the recording industry, that it was very inconvenient for individuals to go out and listen to thousands of bands. You know, that would just take too long, it would be too expensive, and, mm-hmm. you know, I want somebody else to have the job of, you know, listening to all the thousands of bands and then determining which ones are good, and then I'll buy those, right? So the recording industry solved that problem, and it was a totally, at the time, good solution. What we're seeing now with peer-to-peer file sharing and, you know, the emergence of things like MySpace Music and all that is that we no longer need the recording industry to tell us what's good because we have internet.
We tell each other.
Yeah, exactly. We have the ability to communicate that information to each other now in a decentralized way. Well, you know, same thing is true of Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica. You no longer need to have this concentrated pool of experts. I mean, mm-hmm. look at what just happened to the Tribune Company, the major newspaper company that just went bankrupt.
All right. Was that the Chicago Tribune,
yeah.
The LA Times?
Yep. And mm-hmm. I mean, a large part of that is due to the fact that
Seattle PI is up for sale. If nobody buys it, it goes out of existence.
These are all mm-hmm. examples of things that where, you know, decentralized information distribution has replaced centralized
mm-hmm.
information distribution. And I would make the claim that the same exact pattern is going to happen to our money right now. If you know, if we go back again historically to what banks were all about. They had really had two functions. The first was to store our gold. So we actually no longer have a gold standard. There's really, we don't touch gold coins, mm-hmm. or there's, we can't get gold coins when you, that's, there are no gold coins anymore. So that function, you don't need a safe. There's no need for the safe anymore. The second function, however, was actually a lot more subtle, and that's it, as the arbiters of trust in a community. And what that essentially meant was that when the bank was making loans, determining who got access to credit and who didn't, its job was to determine whose promises were trustworthy. In other words, I make a promise to the bank. I promise to pay you $200,000 and over the next 20 years. That's a promise from me. And the bank's job was to determine whose promises were likely to be fulfilled and whose promises weren't. Now, that actually is an important function, because we all know that there are those people who don't fulfill their promises. And if we issued money on the basis willy-nilly all over the place, then very quickly money would have, you know, no meaning at all.
And that's sort of what happened.
Exactly. And I think what we see happening with the power to determine that held in centralized hands, that clearly there's a lot of conflict of interest between assuring the trust of these promises and not. So what we see in with the advent of information technology, I'll give you a really great example. eBay, right? When eBay first came into existence, people said, well, how is this going to work? How can you possibly guarantee that somebody in Memphis, Tennessee is going to, make good on their promise to send some good to, Fort Lauderdale? I mean, it just makes no sense at all. People will be scamming this left and right. Well, what eBay did was put the reputation system in. So if you wanted to, every time you did a transaction, your trustworthiness in the eBay community got recorded and got, and people could, look at that and see if you were a trustworthy person or not. Mm-hmm. And, and if you fell below, 95% positive ratings, people would think very strongly about doing business with you, mm-hmm. right? So that's one very good example of how a public, open reputation system can actually replace the need for a centralized authority to manage trust in a community. Because basically what it comes down to is that people gain more by behaving in a trustworthy fashion than they do by gaming the system.
As long as everybody knows about it.
Exactly. As long as it's open and it's easy to understand and there's an easy user interface for it. And eBay did all these things extraordinarily well.
So is that the kind of the future of our money supply then?
Yes, absolutely. And I, with one other caveat, and that is, there's been a lot of talk about Clay Shirky in his book, Here Comes Everybody, talks a lot about this lowering the cost of failure phenomenon that the internet kind of allows. And basically, if you think about community currencies, first of all, let's just even say there has been now for quite some time a pretty large grassroots movement to address these fundamental flaws in our monetary system in some way or another on the community level. If you think about all of these, though, what they require is a group of people, very, very dedicated and, kind of zealous, you've got to be really into this, to push and push and push and push and try to get this thing together and try and try and try. And then, the reality of it is about 9 out of 10 of these things historically have failed miserably. And really none have broken the, mainstream use barrier at all. So that's a high cost of failure. If you think about, there's maybe between 5 and 10 people out there who have to spend most of their working hours getting this thing together. Mm-hmm. And then, with a 90% chance of failure, that's an extraordinarily high cost. And so you have to be extraordinarily motivated to do that. I think the real future of this thing lies in lowering the cost of failure so that the ability to actually create communities and keep track of who owes who what within a given community will be next to zero. The cost of that will be nominal at best. So in that world, let's just take a leap of the imagination here and say that, you know, we all belong to different communities, right? There's our community of people that we work with, the community of people in our neighborhood, the community of people who we share hobbies, interests with, and so forth and so on. Probably most of us belong to about 5 or 6 different communities. Now, each of those communities that we belong to could have its own currency. And we could be describing our interactions within those communities as, you know, with currency technology. So if I didn't make it completely clear before, I think the key shift that needs to happen here is that money needs to be thought of as an information technology instead of a commodity.
Or keeping track of favors.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. So I'll give you a tangible example. My film here was under the umbrella of Film Action Oregon at the Hollywood Theater. And I don't know, there's about half a dozen, something like that, other projects that they're sponsoring at the moment. You know, one thing about filmmakers is that we tend to have a lot of different skill sets. So I know how to basically hold a camera and edit and light an interview and, you know, all the kind of, and run sound. I can do all those things. And I think most other filmmakers probably are multi-talented in that way to one extent or another. Of course, it's not going to be the incredibly high level professionalism of, you know, Hollywood or something, but I can do it, you know. So when you're making a film, you have to pay for people to come in and hold microphones, set up lights, all that kind of stuff, you know, have a crew. What if a group of people, like, you know, who all wanted to make films came together and instead of all paying each other with dollars, just traded hours working on each other's films. Mm-hmm. So I'll work on this person's film for a few hours, holding the camera, and maybe they'll help me for a few hours on some animations or something like that. And because we have a common goal, we have a common purpose in mind, which is we all want to make films. Mm-hmm. We all want to do this, and none of us have gigantic budgets of Hollywood. Coming together and collaborating like that actually becomes possible. And a currency is what enables that.
You know, it reminds me of the Amish barn raisings.
Exactly.
I just read about one. It's just amazing. These guys, they put up a barn in just a few days, you know, and they knew exactly how to do it. They sort of had their own, you know, their sort of traditional plan for the barn. Everybody knew what to do. And they just, and some guy who was sort of a contractor type went along to watch this and was skeptical, but he turned out to be really amazed, you know, the way they put up this barn so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and then the Amish bank, there was some bank, I just read about this the other day, there's some bank, I think in Pennsylvania, that does most of its business with Amish farmers, and they've had no problem at all. You know, they're thriving, and the farmers are prosperous. They don't use any mechanical stuff. They use horses and oxen for their plowing and everything like that.
Yeah. Know? Well, that's a great point because it shows that participatory wealth creation is not limited to online services or things like that. It's the participatory wealth creation has been the foundation for many communities, and the Amish are a great example. I think if we really look at, where things are going in the next 10 to 20 years, and we look at things like, you know, the success of Wikipedia and all these other models, I think we can safely say that the information age encourages these sort of innate capacities that we already have, you know, things like the Amish barn raising, it encourages these innate capacities and enables them to a large extent. So I think that's going to be the fundamental paradigm that kind of takes over from this industrial paradigm. I don't think the industrial thing is going to go away. But I think a lot of the function that is currently attributed to the industrial way of doing things is going to shift into this participatory
way.
It's
like a new system growing within the old or something.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, I think, where you get into this idea of many different currencies describing many different communities and the overlap of these communities. And there's some very, you know, interesting and powerful overlaps of human interaction. I've heard it referred to as neo-tribalism. So in other words, that, the idea being that we don't, it's no longer like us versus them, you know, the sort of like, you know, we're all in the tribe and everybody else is outside, mm-hmm. but we are all part of many tribes now. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's the overlap and the interplay of those is what enables modern society.
Well, even collapse takes a long time. I read an article. There's a guy in Ashland, John Michael Greer, who's an arch druid, and he writes about peak oil. And he did a study of all these societies that collapsed, the ones you think of, you know, the Mayans and the Indians of the Southwest and other places. And the average time it took a society to collapse is something like 150 years.
Mm.
So the idea of just a sudden, right. you know, the whole building comes down around you, you know, that is really not true. No. It's a slow thing. So, well, I think our time is just about up. We've been talking with Alan Rosenblith, who has a movie, sort of an updated, reworked film called The Money Fix. And it is... we'll be playing at the Hollywood Theater. I guess this is one night only.
Yeah, I should also say it's doing its world premiere at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival in Missoula. And that's going to be in February. But we're doing a sneak preview of it here on January 29th.
So if you don't see it here, you got to go up to Missoula. That's kind of a nice town anyway, you know?
Absolutely.
Sure. So anyway, this is Thursday, January 29th, 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. If you have anything more, we got about 1 minute left. Where do you think we're going? You think we'll have a jubilee, or you think we'll just kind of
grow
something new?
I think the a lot of people, you know, hear about money and they tend to get very, you know, tense and worried about it. I think the most important thing, though, as FDR said, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the future looks a heck of a lot better than the past.
Mm-hmm.
When we start thinking about what we can really do and really freeing up our imaginative and creative capacities, I think there's a lot to look forward to.
Go boldly where no bank has dared to go before. Okay, thank you very much. I think I will strive mightily to be at the... I want to see this movie. I saw the original one, and I would like to see it again. So thank you very much for being with us.
Great. Thank you
Stay
so much.
Stay tuned, folks. People are coming in. I think there's something good coming up next. So stay tuned to KBOO.